the general lines that we outlined for our expectations, that we should have moderated our support then and given him the impression that, you know, this was not just a blank check, but that we expected to have certain general progress made in the country. But we ended up never doing that. We ended up pretty much responding to all of his complaints and putting ourselves in a defensive posture. And I think he got the impression that Americans were generally fairly malleable in the political process. And I think that was not helpful to his later policy. He became, I think, over-impressed with his own ability to control events and really sort of lost sight of objective facts when he got into the later stages, particularly when he formed the so-called Rastakhiz Party, the Resurgence Party, where he really just almost became leader of, in a communist style situation where everyone is with me and I'm going to get 99.7% support, or people who are not with me are going to leave the country. I mean, that was really the way it came down in the very final stages along in 75 and 76.
Huh. According to one of the reports that I've seen from the Kennedy period, it was a document by Philip Talbot. This is partly a quote. He says it was U.S. policy to combine vigorous but discreet political and economic advice to the Shah with enough assistance to enable him and the Iranian government to survive and go forward. So apparently there was some assumption in Washington that there would be policy to further encourage the Shah to move in a certain reformist direction.
Yes.
Give him advice, but how much of an effort along that line did you see in their homes?
I really can't say about what Holmes told the Shah, because I just was not anywhere near the scene.
Exactly.
But my impression from reporting that scene was that on occasion the Shah sought Holmes's advice on things, and Holmes gave it either directly when he had a feeling he could give it directly, or when he needed to check with Washington and get back. I think he was fairly good about giving some advice to the Shah, but when we came along to Armin Meyer and eventually to MacArthur, I think he found sort of an extreme in MacArthur's case of a man who just really never told the Shah anything that would be the least bit derogatory or in the nature of giving him advice on how he should conduct himself or his affairs. It was just going to hear the Shah's complaints and then writing back or telegraphing back to Washington how we had to bend every effort to resolve the things that were curbing the Shah. It really became pretty much of a one-way street later on, and I think that was unfortunate.
Also, according to one of the task force reports that I've seen, I guess there was something interesting in Washington and encouraging the Shah moving for the more constitutional role, in the sense that the Prime Minister would have a fair amount of policy-making authority in the system. I guess maybe people saw Amini as sort of a move in that direction. Did you get any kind of a sense of how far the Kennedy administration wanted the Shah to move in this sense, or towards that they encouraged that kind of a evolution towards a more constitutional
I don't think that there was any very well-developed idea of just what we thought should evolve in Iran. It was more or less the question of general trends. We wanted maybe a trend toward, the Prime Minister running the country in a day-to-day sense, and the Shah becoming perhaps a little less involved in political machinations. But it was not a detailed plan of action. I don't think we ever felt we could tell the Iranians exactly how to organize themselves, but it was just a question of these general trends. But then, of course, later on, as the Shah got more secure in his power base, he began to search for people who would not be independent. I mean, Hassan Ali Mansour, who eventually was assassinated, was the prototype of the yes man. person who salutes and goes off and does exactly what the Shah wants. And so I think that perhaps is a function of the Shah's political development. During the Amini period, he was still not really terribly forceful. He showed many times he wasn't quite sure what should be done. And, that gave Amini a chance to propose certain things, and the Shah could sort of say, well, okay, try that, or don't do that, or something. But later, as the Shah began to feel more secure in his power base, he began to look for people who would do his bidding. Mansur comes to mind as I say, pretty much as a yes man. Then you get to Hoveyda, who is, a very difficult person to analyze in that context, because he was sort of both. I mean, he did what the Shah wanted, but he also had enough experience in oil negotiations and economic affairs to have his own ideas, and he gave the impression of someone who tried to run everyday affairs of the government in a fairly reasonable way. He impressed a lot of visitors, in my experience, with his grasp of development issues and his involvement in every phase of government activity. Yes, he did what the Shah told him, but he managed to give the impression that he was, to some extent, his own man, too. So there was a much more ambivalent assessment, I would say, of his situation than there was in other cases.
Did the AID have operations around Tigris? Were there any AID programs
or
projects?
Yes, there was an aid mission. I'm sorry, it's a good point, because I didn't even include him before. The reason I didn't include him is that he had no direct tie to the consulate whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
He was he had a separate office and separate line of command from the aid mission in Tehran. He even had his own vehicles, his own motor pool, so that we were in a strange position on occasion of the aid director offering to the Governor General several vehicles that could be used during the Shah's visit or whatever big occasion they had to help him out with his transportation needs, when the consulate had one beat-up Chevrolet car for the consul and one station wagon for everything else, and then the branch PAO had a station wagon and of course movie equipment and so on. But I mean, our facilities were quite limited for what we were doing, and AID by comparison had a lot of vehicles and office space and personnel and budget much more generous than we had.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of an odd impression vis-a-vis the local government, because they had the impression of this very senior aide director, Houston Crippen, very imposing and very nice man, very, very courtly gentleman, who had all these resources at his control, and then this very active consulate that was really strapped for resources. So it gave a sort of an odd impression, I think, to the Governor General and his staff, as to the relationship of the consulate and the aid mission.
Did you get a sense of what they were doing in that part of the country?
Oh, yeah.
What the AID project was.
We knew all the kind of projects they were involved in. They had agricultural projects, education projects. There was a very active program, but I'm a little bit skeptical about results, because I think the earlier period in Iran, when they had done a fantastic amount of grassroots development, drilling wells and spraying for malaria, just tremendous number of physical attributes all over the country that were provided by Aslachar, as the Iranians call it, 0.4.
Oh.
They translated that literally, Aslachar, 6.4, and Abe is always known as Ask the Child, no matter what period.
The lineal descendant, I guess, in terms of...
Yeah, it was. But, you know, through FOA, Foreign Operations Administration...
International Cooperation.
International Cooperation Administration. All these alphabet things we did over the years, the runners never bothered us. It was always Ask the Child. It was very simple. But, you know, in the earlier period, there was a tremendous amount. I mean, everyone you talked to said, oh, yes, they drilled a well in my village, or they sprayed in for malaria. You see spray-painted signs in small villages now. Sprayed through here on such a day, DDT, whatever. But by the time I was there, I felt they were getting a little bit bogged down in paperwork and, you know, planning from Tehran and reports to Washington. A little more, I think, inefficient in their actual delivery of help to the grassroots.
I think there's a lot of, at this time, late 50s, early 50s, there's a fair amount of congressional criticism of foreign aid operations in developing countries, especially Iran, I guess. Do you think the projects are fairly sound that were being paid for at this time? Did you get a sense of, you said there's a problem with inefficiency, but beyond that, were the projects actually...
Well, I think the projects were good.
Yeah.
There were things like entomological programs to control insect pests, and there were... seed projects, and so I mean, perhaps it was that progress in the earlier days was so much more visible. By this time, we were seeing developments from the earlier days where people were being sent to training in the States, people came back and were working their way up in ministry. All kinds of earlier infrastructure had been laid for progress, and I think it was always that. Disappointing because you sent people to the States for a very kind of training, they came back, and then for one reason or another they were maneuvered into other jobs, and they never quite did what they were trained for. There's a lot of just institutional grinding of gears that I think was a bit disappointing for some of the people who had high hopes for developments sort of taking off. You know, we were still in that period when we talked about countries taking off and development. And, all that analysis is still being applied to countries like Iran.
Oh, do the CIA have people coming to RIS once in a while, or was there a CIA person stationed there?
Yes, and they did have people coming occasionally, but that was something I just didn't get involved in it was, you know, it was arranged with the consul, and I was, I mean, I knew who. There people were, but it was essentially outside of my particular sphere. Except, of course, when I was in charge, and I could be brought aboard about certain things. But in general, I stayed out of that.
Right. I'll talk about that later on. But just, I guess around. Late 52, early 53, the Shah announces his 9-point, I guess, or 6-point reform program, with land reform and sports, rights for women, educational reform, and so forth. And I guess there was a national referendum on the plebiscite.
Yes. Right, plebiscite.
On the Shah's program.
Right.
Supposedly 99% of those who voted, like 6 million people, voted for the Shah's program. Did you observe the plebiscite or see it take place? Or?
I didn't actually see it take place in a sense of being right there and watching people line up and so on. I did see people in Tabriz voting, and we had all kinds of information about how the affair went. They had a program of inking people's fingers, their thumb, once they voted, so that they would not be able to vote again. And I'm sure it couldn't have been 99% of people who voted.
That's what the books say, though.
No, I know.
Yeah. But 99% of those...
Of those voting voted in favor.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, again, you know, if there had been a vote on individual items of the reform program, there probably would have been an awful lot of negative votes, as I say, about women's suffrage. But when it was a package deal, you know, everyone said, well, the whole reform package, what are we going to do? We vote no, it's going to happen anyway. So everyone just sort of fell in line and figured, A, the Shah wants it, so he's probably going to get it, so why, we might as well go along. And B, there are some good aspects to it, you know, land reform, if that gives me some land, fine. Literacy Corps, if that teaches my kids in the village to read, then I'm all for it. Health Corps, if that brings a doctor to my village even once a year, it's better than what I have now, so, you know, that'd be fine. House of Justice, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. We had these disputes going on for years. If we can get House of Justice in the nearby village, maybe we can resolve them. You know, I mean, there were enough positive aspects, I think, that a lot of people would sort of go along with it just for that reason, too. So I think probably was a general vote in favor, but the percentage is obviously...
Yeah, it's amazing, a high turnout. Was there any sort of subtle coercion for people to vote? I mean, I guess having a black mark on your finger, if you didn't have one, it meant you would not have voted. So that, was there any sort of implicit sanctions about not participating in the...
Sure. It was the thing to do. And they made sure that people were allowed to vote in their villages or nearby towns. Transportation was arranged, you know, all kinds of ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. I really don't recall a great deal specifics about that, but we weren't surprised that there was an overwhelming vote in favor.
Now, during the first months of the same year, 63, there was some fair amount of growing anti-Shah activity around the country. I think, from what I've read at least, the Ayatollah Khomeini was becoming a major figure in the opposition, the national opposition to the Shah. And there was growing clerical criticism of the Shah. And apparently, during these months, early 63, there was government attacks on religious schools in Qom, and apparently Tabriz as well during these months. Did you know much about the attacks on the religious schools? Or was that something that was fairly visible in your recollection?
Well, it was quite well reported in the press, so it was certainly well known. Again, it focused largely around the reform program because, for one thing, there were many reasons for the clerics to be opposed to land reform, too. For one thing, there had been a nice little symbiotic relationship in most villages between the village mullah and the landlord, because as long as the relationships were good between them, the mullah told the peasants to, you know, accede to the will of Allah and be a good citizen and not create a lot of unrest here on earth, because you know, we must all live with the situations as we find them, and we'll find paradise after we die, so let's just all sort of pull together and not raise a lot of fuss. Implicit was this sort of understanding that if the peasants behave themselves, then they'll be treated reasonably well, and the mullah could intercede in a case of hardship. But the mullah was in turn treated well by the landlord, looked up to and revered and so on, and the mullah taught the only literacy class in the village, and he was the only literate person in the village. He would teach the kids reading and writing through the Quran. So there was this relationship, and then once the landlords were deprived of their land, that upset the situation. In some cases, later, lands belonging to the church were going to be confiscated and distributed among the peasants. Not all, certainly, but some lands were going to be taken away from clerical control. Villages that have been, say, deeded by the owner to a mosque or to some religious endowment were going to be affected by land reform. And that was anathema too, because that you're taking away some of the support for the church. Furthermore, there were sort of analytical grounds for being concerned about land reform. Question of whether possession of one person can be taken away by the government and given to somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say you take the land from the landlord and give it to the peasant who's farming it, but from a theological standpoint, the Mullah could argue that ownership of land is sacred, and you know, there's no temporal right of the government to come in and take the money from one person and give it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So there are all kinds of reasons why there were doubts by clerical leaders about the reform package. Mm-hmm. Certain things they wouldn't have opposed, houses of justice and things like that, obviously in favor of them. But then again, that women's rights question, you know, that that really was dangerous. I mean, Mullah was just, you know, they were very traditional minded. As you know, the mosque is segregated, men on one side, women on another. They just, you know, the idea of giving women the vote in any role in affairs is just anathema to current leaders. So, Khomeini and others engaged in a lot of ferment behind the scenes, telling people that they shouldn't sit by while the government ran these reforms down their throats. Mm-hmm. And of course, that culminated in the June 63 riots in Tehran, which, again, I only heard about indirectly. One, obviously, the press report, but two, I was down in Tehran just days after it happened and met with some of the junior officers just socially, and they were describing some of the scenes of just really wanton brutality on both sides. So, telephone kiosks being destroyed, and traffic lights smashed, and any symbol of authority, banks, buses, whatever, was attacked by mobs. And then, of course, the government reacted with overwhelming force, and lots of people killed. And of course, there were then the official reports of death, and then there were the unofficial rumors, much, much higher casualties. And so it was a real time of concern. Mm-hmm. And we did have unrest in Tabriz.
Did you witness any of the demonstrations there?
I was not in the midst of them, but one day when we expected demonstrations, we made a quick foray around town just to see what we could see, and you know, troops everywhere and all kinds of control. What they did, as I recall, quite harder, they had troops lined up in the bazaar area, which was of course a hotbed of activity because the clerics are very strong in the bazaar, a lot of links there, and so the government said you must open the shops, and the merchants are going to keep them closed as a protest. And it was something like you're having now in Palestine.
Exactly.
Open, close. And the poor merchants are like, what am I going to do? The government says open up, and then the mob's going to come in and destroy my place. So the government had their troops lined up, and they would have one group in the foreground kneeling, aiming their guns at the mob, and then another group was standing behind with their guns aimed in the air, and then on the signal they would be volley of shots. And of course the crowd didn't know whether it was the guys aiming here or the guys aiming here who were going to actually shoot. And of course the guys aiming in the air were the ones who pulled the triggers, so you just had all these shots in the air. But it was very effective in showing the rioters that the government was prepared to do what they could to keep control. So as I witnessed the situation, the government in Tabriz kept the lid on very tight and avoided the kind of
loss of life
casualties and things like that. But it was dicey. Yeah. Yeah.
How much concern was there among U.S. officials after the events in Tehran that political repression of that scale might really be counterproductive in terms of the Shah's position in the country? Was there much concern on that angle?
Well, there was concern, I think, that events would get out of hand, but because the government had reacted so strongly to the protests, that there might be a whole cycle of further violence by a mob and further repression, and you know, the whole thing could just snowball. The result was that the situation did calm down, and the presidential family was expelled and went off to Iraq, and it continued. And now one other period that's, I think, very important to keep in mind is the issue of capitulations, which came up.
Yeah, I wasn't asked about that.
The status of forces agreement we were trying to get the alliance to agree to, so that when military people were assigned in Iran, they would have some rights in case of accidents or whatever, that they'd be treated by in some way that would be defensible to the folks back home, and yet would not be offensive to Iranians. It was very tough because in the Middle East there was this tradition of capitulations and special treatment for foreigners, and the Iranians were very sensitive to that, and the mullahs were very adept at bringing up the parallel between capitulations and what in the status of forces agreement. And the Majlis, very unusual development, kicked up its heels and barely approved it, and it was very close, and there were fiery speeches, and we won't accept this kind of pressure from the U.S. And Mansour was just taken aback because he was trying to hold things under control and show the Shah that he was managing the situation. And I went to some of the Majlis debates and heard people taking their positions, and it was amazing to see this allegedly rubber stamp parliament kick up its heels and take a different view. And
but people were really surprised by what happened, I think.
We were surprised by the vociferousness of the opposition point of view in the parliament, and the degree to which this became a popular issue. And they all sort of fed into the same kind of chaos that was going on in that general time.
This was 64, I think, right?
Yeah, this was 64, but, people were very mindful of what happened in 63.
Right.
And see, if people are this upset about it, maybe there's a permit beneath the scene that we're just beginning to see again. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of concern about that.
I've seen reports by General Eckhart, who was the Irish Mag Chief during the mid-60s, and he noted the strong connection between the mullahs and political dissidents generally, among the middle classes, the Bazari and so forth. And he observed in this report, it's sort of interesting, that the mullahs were the opposition group with the greatest ability to lead an uprising against the Shah. To what extent did other U.S. officials see, during this period, share this estimate of leadership ability of the mullahs in terms of leading an uprising, a revolution at some point?
I think the embassy was fairly well aware of that general proclivity because particularly, I can speak from experience that I was the political officer in charge of, if you will, use that expression, contact with the opposition and reporting on what the opposition was doing. And I had various National Front contacts and other people, including Shapur Bakhtiar, and various people, either directly or through contacts of theirs. There are some people that have been contacts with the embassy over the years. One is Hidayatullah Mateen Daftari, who is a grandson of Mossadegh. Mateen Daftari was a lawyer and very clearly a National Front person because of his relationship to Mossadegh, and he was occasionally questioned or thrown in jail for a while by the regime over the years. But through all these various people, I was trying to keep just an idea of what the opposition was doing and report on all the significant aspects of opposition. And one question was always, well, how much are the religious people involved in it? And so through various questions, I got an introduction to an Ayatollah Qutsi, Q-O-T-S-I, who was suggested to me as a contact, because he was a person who was fairly high up in the religious hierarchy, but not so high that he couldn't talk to a foreigner, and that he was understanding and, you know, really wanted to learn more about our position on things, as well as tell us about religious people's views. And so I used to periodically meet with him. I'd just go over to his house and sit around on the cushions on the floor and talk about what was going on. Mm-hmm. And it was very informative. And, you know, I always wrote up everything I learned about him. I don't know anything about him anymore, whether he's still around or whatever. And you may be aware of some things that have come out in the Iranian press carrying what are purported to be U.S. Documents that were seized in the embassy.
Oh, the capture documents.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's one there, I have a copy of somewhere, which purports to be a memorandum that I wrote about my various contacts. We'll have to go into it later.
Yeah, yeah.
And anyway, Kotsi is listed there, so I don't know what happened to people who are identified openly as contacts of the American Embassy. Obviously, in a society like that where no one trusts the press, everything is based on who knows what and rumors and gossip, and I know so-and-so who said this happened, and is that true, and you find out somebody else's view, and it's a great rumor-mongering society with people valuing their contacts based on how much they really know, you know, and they really, with a fairly small number of phone calls or personal visits, people find out a tremendous amount of information from people who are in the know. There was a system of do-rays or groups that had written about by Binder and other analysts about, you know, how information was transmitted in Iranian society. And if you were in the right do-ray, you would have contacts with a lot of other people in various walks of life, and among that group that met periodically, you could find out anything that was going on, really. And that's why people depended for their factual information, was on the contacts they had with various people. And the press was just something to look at and snicker about, because, you know, you could see something in the press and then you'd find out the real story from your friends and evaluate why the government said this when in fact the truth is this. Anyway, I was saying that Gortsi was this very good contact, and to give me some ideas of clerical views about Iran, and he kept harking back to our support for the Shah, which is looked upon by Iranians as immoral. You know, you're supporting a man who has no appreciation of our background, because he's not a religious man. He doesn't pay enough attention to religion. He's spending all his money on arms. He should be spending money on education and food for children and, you know, all the things that are needed in this country of ours. But he's spending it on arms and wasting our oil revenues. And, you know, I mean, we had many discussions along this line. And I think that was instructive. I always wrote up these conversations, and I felt that the religious angle should always be carefully explored. Even Hertz had some contacts with people who had contacts with noted clergymen, and the embassy in general, I think, was attuned from top to bottom to the importance of religion. Unfortunately, when I came back in 75, I felt that there was not nearly the same attention given to the effect of religion on politics. And I, in a session once at the embassy, I even recommended that we start cultivating religious figures again to find out just what they were thinking about. And she cited the importance of religion in their lives, as I saw it, even from my home up in Northern Tehran, give some examples, but everyone said, well, let's think about it. But, and by that time, we, I think, had evolved in this position where we just didn't do anything that might upset the Shah, and so the pros and cons of finding out about religious sentiment were considered to be, you know, that the pros are considered to be inadequate in view of the cons that might result from the Shah being angry that we were in touch with others. So we just didn't do it. Yeah.
You mentioned one thing earlier about, was it widely assumed among the educated, literate people at this time, or religious people in the U.S., that the fact had played a major role in bringing the Shah back in 53?
That was the assumption. That was dogma.
Yeah.
Everybody you talked to just cited that as gospel truth, which obviously, at the time, we fuzzed the issue. We kept saying that, if anyone asked us, there were allegations that this had happened or something. We never said it openly, but then later, of course, Clement Rundle's book came out, and Cottam's book came out, and, a lot of open discussion of it. But when I first came there, it was still a sort of taboo subject, but every Iranian you talked to...
Yes, the embassy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you, as an embassy person, met Iranians, you never never brought it up, but the Iranians, right away, said, well, of course, you Americans put him on the throne, so, you put him on the throne, why can't you tell him what to do? They'd say, if he's not doing this and so and this and so, well, why don't you tell him to do it? You guys put him on, if he weren't for you, he wouldn't be in power. So, when you said, well, Iran's a sovereign country, we can't tell sovereign countries what to do, we can influence them somewhat, but you can't just order them around. I mean, this is your country. No, come on. You guys put him in power. You can tell him to do anything. Because they have a view just like everything's a puppet. And who's pulling the strings? The Americans, the British, the Soviets. They have this expression, Das Kharaji, the foreign hand. Das Kharaji is everyone. Everyone was analyzed. In terms of where is his support? Is he pro-British, pro-American, pro-American, some other country? Everybody was analyzed that way. That was one of the lexicons of Persian political thought. There are all kinds of details that I shouldn't get into because there are many side issues. But books like Binder's book about political systems, he has a whole long chapter about Iran and how it works. And then later on you have that book based on interviews with Iranians by Marvin Zonis. I knew Marvin when he was out there, and he was very energetic in having Iranians fill out these questionnaires that he had, and then he analyzed the data and wrote this long book about it. So there are all kinds of people out there. I met James Bill out there just before I left in 66. I met him when he was out there doing some of his first research. So a lot of people were analyzing Iran, a lot of ferment of ideas and so on over the years. It's been a subject of great interest to a lot of people studying politics and international development.
Oh, going back, Lester, so you became a political officer of the embassy in late 63. How did that come about? Was it a natural progression of things?
Well, it was a natural progression because I'd been through the language and area training, so I knew that obviously a good part of my career would be tied up with Farsi-speaking countries, and so when I finished in Tabriz, it was widely assumed that either that next assignment or another one would be in Iran. So I was willing to go to the capital for the next assignment. I felt, having been in the provinces, it was quite a natural progression to then come to the center, and gave me a good ground. And I think I better check on that.
Okay.
Well, we had a quite a large political section in those days, and because we did, that we were allowed to then somewhat specialize within the section. So some people dealt more with external political relations, I opted to do something more on the domestic side because I'd been in Tabriz, I had the language. Of course, language capability was quite general in those days. We had a lot of people on our staff who spoke good Farsi. People I still work with and can converse with in Farsi and we meet, that sort of thing. But I expressed an interest in continuing to report on the reform program and also to follow the opposition, and that was agreed to. And so that was one of my assignment, my assigned area within the political section. Mm-hmm.
You did that pretty much for the following 3 years with Q1 in Toronto?
Yes. Let me back up now. Okay. I did have, through some complicated maneuvering behind the scenes, I did have a period of time when I had to serve in the consular section. Obviously, every red-blooded FSO wanted to serve in the political section, or if not there, in the economic section, and oftentimes work in the consular section is considered to be much less desirable. One, because of the tremendous pressure involved, and just hundreds and hundreds of applicants, you know, lining up every day, and you were supposed to apply rules that are rather hard to apply and practice, and find out who was really a bona fide non-immigrant and who was just trying to get to the States to end up living there and getting a job and living a good life. Anyway, I because of certain trades back and forth, I was first put into the consular section. I did non-immigrant visa work and then citizenship and passport work. So really for the first half year, first 6 months of my assignment, I was doing that.
Late 53, early 54.
Yeah. And then I went into the political section and did the duties that I just mentioned. So essentially for the next 2 years. So that's why the assignment was here, sort of 2.5 years, because I came right after Kennedy's assassination and then served till the summer of 66 before I came back to the States.
You talked a bit about Julius Holmes. Who were some of the other officials of the embassy when you were working there in 53, 54, following you? Some
well,
major
of course,
people, I guess.
Holmes was replaced by Armin Meyer.
Right.
And right away, I think the fact that the analysis bubbled up from the bottom, that began to change because Meyer had come from Beirut, felt that he knew the Middle East well from his service there, and he took to writing a lot of his own reports to Washington, just parts left blank for us to fill in or where our views were solicited, but he basically had all laid out what he was going to say. And I think this was a frustrating time for everyone in the political section, because the transition from Holmes to him to Armin Meyer was quite drastic, and we felt that Iran was considerably different from the Levant, and we thought that he needed more time to understand this new situation before he started analyzing the whole thing for Washington's benefit. But he had his own view, and I think, as I said before, I think too, with his talks with the Shah, he got off on a foot where he pretty much became a channel for everything that the Shah wanted to complain about or have set right, and everything was dutifully reported to Washington. You know, as if the measure of his effectiveness was to get done the things that the Shah wanted done in Washington. Mm-hmm. So I think ushered in a sequence of people who more or less played that same role, so the Shah got the impression that he could manipulate Washington's views through the approach that he took to the American ambassador in Tehran.
who were some of the other people that, you know, on Hull was there, on IR there, that you worked with in the embassy? I mean, who did you report to, for example? Who was the chief of the political section? Or was it?
Martin Hertz.
Oh, Martin Hertz. Okay.
Yeah, because by the time I got into the section, he was firmly ensconced as the head of the political section. He had come in the, as I say, in the fall, no, early fall or late summer of 83, because I first met him when I was still in Tabriz. In fact, I remember one of my last analytical pieces that I did in Tabriz was a piece on attitudes toward the reform program, which he was soliciting from various posts, and, you know, to brief him as, in his new job as the political counselor. Harry Schwartz, I think, is the predecessor, who I, of course, knew, but I didn't interact with a great deal. And then, so as I say, we had Hertz heading the political section. Dan Newberry, for a while, was under him, but then Newberry got transferred, and Bill Helseth came in as the sort of deputy political counselor. Mm-hmm. And then there was a whole group of people in the section. Victor Wolf and Tom Green, Charles Rossi.
Was Bill Miller in the section?
Myself. Miller...